everyone. I'm Gary Knoll. This is the Progressive Commentary Hour. Today, our theme is climate change and the future of humanity. My guest, from New Zealand, Kevin Hester. He is the host of the radio program Nature Batch Last with climate change scholar Guy McPherson, Professor Emeritus, which airs on the Progressive Radio Network every Tuesday at 3 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. Kevin lives on a small off-the-grid island in the Gulf over there, 15 miles from the city of Auckland, New Zealand. Kevin has completed 16 ocean passages on a small yacht, over half of them as a skipper. He was once arrested and charged with obstructing a nuclear ship in the course of his passage, and was at the bomb Greenpeace Rainbow Warrior within an hour of the detonation and the murder of one of the persons on there. And it was by the French DGSE, which is equivalent to our CIA, back in July of 1985. Kevin currently spends his time researching abrupt climate change and the collapse of complex societies and the real-time unraveling of the biosphere. His articles can be found on his website, kevinhester.live. Also joining us today from Ottawa, Canada, is Professor Paul Beckwith. He is a physicist, an engineer, and a postdoctoral candidate in the Laboratory of Paleoclimatology and Climatology at the University of Ottawa in Ontario, where he also teaches as a part-time professor. Paul's research specializes in abrupt effects from climate change, such as tornadoes, and the rise in more fierce tropical storms and greenhouse gas emissions, and the global implications of the melting Arctic sea ice and social media for climate change advocacy. He's a member and a participant of the Arctic Methane Emergency Group and the Canadian Meteorological and Oceanographic Society. His website is Paul Beckwith, that's BECKWITH.net, and he offers many educational videos about climate change science on his YouTube channel under his name. Nice to have you both with us today.
Absolute pleasure to be here, Gary, and to be with you too, Paul. I'm a huge admirer of your work.
Well, likewise. Hello, everybody.
All right, what I'm going to do is this. I'm so concerned about what is happening and the media's disconnect from the consequences of this that I'm going to do a little longer introduction than normal, sharing my own views. Then I'm going to divide the program up for both of you to take the rest of the program to address the issues I'm concerned with as well as your own concerns, all right? And this begins for me approximately 10 years ago when I began to see some troubling events occurring that the media was not paying attention to. In fact, many people within the environmental movement were also not on point or focused. I did a series of programs. In 1 week, I did 5 hours on my national radio program on the tipping points. And at that time, there were only 12 tipping points. Today, there's over almost 40. And of those 12 tipping points, for example, the slowing of the conveyor belt that takes warm water from the southern hemisphere, brings it up around Ireland, Iceland, and brings cold water back down, it was slowing. And then the question is, how slow would it get? What would be the consequences? And what was the evidence for that? Another one was on the melting of the ice caps in the Himalayas and in Arctic areas, in Antarctica, Greenland. And how fast were these warming and thawing and pouring fresh water into the oceans? And that's just as an example. And we were concerned that maybe one or more of those within our lifetime would tip. That was 10 years ago. As of today, we have 10 that have tipped. There's nothing anyone on this planet can do to reverse that. And yet, we are doing, in this country at least, nothing. Now, part of what I'm going to weave together may seem like disparate points, but they're all interconnected. Example, and this is where I'm going to reverse engineer my construct. The average person believes that if it were that bad, environmental catastrophes or global warming or unique weather events, the government would let us know, our state government, our local government, our federal government, FEMA. We would be forewarned. We would be prepared. And if it was really bad, we would be taken out of harm's way. Nothing could be further from the truth. But that's what we believe. That's a myth. A second myth that 10 years ago and over the subsequent years, we have been led to believe by almost 2,000 scientists who are involved in various aspects of climate change and degradation of our planet and the overuse of, let's say, finite resources, destroying the hardwood forests like China is doing and Japan is doing in South America, Central America, and Peru, for example, where a lot of that hardwood comes to make your furniture, they're running out of it. In fact, many of the resources we need to sustain life, we're running out of. We're halfway through this year, and already we've used a full year's worth of these resources. And no one seems to be of concern on this issue. So we had the media not covering it, including many environmental groups. In fact, the last time I was asked to be the keynote speaker, in fact, the only speaker, on Earth Day at the UN in Equinox, I had a room filled with environmental group leaders. It was packed, standing room only. Now, I had a choice when I went up there. Normally, you would do a lecture about the environment and what everyone's doing and how we should be optimistic and let's all get together. But I didn't. Instead, I took that opportunity, and I filmed it, and you can see it on my YouTube channel, where I excoriated the heads, literally, of all the environmental groups. I gave examples of how some of the largest money makers, and one group, I think it was $500 million a year, there were certain areas of the environmental destruction they wouldn't touch because the people giving the money were the very people causing that destruction. And I saw these warped and perverse alliances. So on the one hand, there was a cognitive disconnect. Yes, we're for environment, but then you're not going to talk about fracking or global warming. And so it was one of those days when you risked being booed off the stage, but there was stunned silence. And afterwards, as I was leaving, this Indian gentleman came up, and he was a high-ranking official. I'd never met him, didn't know who he was, at the UN, a man from India. And he says, man, we needed to hear this, but no one felt good listening to it. And I said, I wasn't here to make people feel good. I was here to share what I thought was the necessary truth. So we don't have people at the highest levels of UN, environmental groups, the U.S. government, many of the international governments, including the government of China, Brazil, India, who are also major polluters. There are some governments, like in Germany, Norway, Denmark, that are far more in tune and doing what they can to decrease some aspects of global warming. But then it's very myopic. It's not looking at what happens to food in your country when it gets too hot. But other things like the rising sea waters, they're doing some good things with. In any case, I then started looking at what is the academic community doing to instill this urgency of information into an intentionally ignorant student body. And having taught at the university level for 35 years, I'm now at a point where I don't want to teach anymore because I don't see the critical thinking students who want to know how to think deeply, look for the truth, and be capable of deconstructing the myths and illusions in their own learning system. And with that, I then said, well, maybe there's grassroots movement, but there's not. Instead, we have the professional community, the careerists, lawyers, doctors, engineers, professors, architects, and CPAs, people with higher education, people who are critical thinkers in their field and generally successful, and there's 17.2 million. Well, just do the math. If the average family in the United States contains four people, and you have, let's just round it off to 17 million times four, you're at 68 million people living in the United States who are policymakers or opinion leaders, either people that frequently could get to or join or have been members of think tanks at different, either conservative, liberals, or relevant, They have the capacity to reach the public. They're also members of the media. They're some of our best and brightest. They come from the Ivy League schools and are respected for their acumen and intellect. Silent. Then you have 10 million millionaires. So that's another 40 million people. And these millionaires have political contacts and are capable of getting a message through the media if they choose to. They choose not to. So when I look at the solutions, I'm seeing 110 million people, one-third of the American population, who are doing absolutely positively nothing, with a tiny fraction, maybe under 0.01%, actually actively, proactively doing something. Then I look at the poor class, nothing. I look at the working middle class, nothing. So I came to the conclusion this week that if we're expecting a House, a Senate, a Parliament of wise men and women to save us, we're fools. That we are not going to change. We are incapable of change. And the reasoning and logic behind it is simple. If a mother and father feed junk food to their child, watching that child develop obesity and diabetes and arthritis and heart disease before the age of six, what is the likelihood that a hamburger-eating, beer-swilling, pizza-loving, porn-watching person is going to have the spiritual consciousness to care about the trees and the capacity of those trees to sustain carbon sinks, the fish not to be killed by acidification and green and overgrowth of algae, red algae, the depletion of oxygen? And what is the likelihood they're going to wake up one day, not go to McDonald's, not go to Walmart, not go to the computer, and actually do something? How about zero? So we are living in this disconnect between wanting a utopian outcome and fueling a dystopian reality. So then my conclusion was simple. We're not all going to make it in the lifeboat, and we're not in enough pain to change. And even in pain, people frequently don't change. You're living in a place that's non-sustainable. California, the entire state. You have fires today. You have one of the worst fires and could end up being the worst fire in American history. Not just California history, the car fire. And you'll still go back and live in the same place if you can get the insurance to rebuild your house. You're already on an earthquake fault. Doesn't seem to matter. You're running out of water. Doesn't seem to matter. You're living in Arizona, non-sustainable. Oklahoma, non-sustainable. New Mexico, non-sustainable. Kansas, non-sustainable. Colorado, non-sustainable. Washington State, non-sustainable. Oregon, non-sustainable. Florida, non-sustainable. Most of Texas, non-sustainable. New Mexico, Nevada, non-sustainable. So half of America's 50 states, not including the protectorate of Puerto Rico, which is non-sustainable, are non-sustainable. Not a single governor of a single state has suggested that maybe this isn't the best place to live and start a methodical and a proper way of relocating people who would like to relocate and looking at a worst-case scenario and planning for it, putting tax dollars to it. Not a single movement. They're still building. They're right in the process right now of constructing a $3 billion shopping center down in Miami Beach. So I'm looking at a world where the scientists are liars. They're trying to be so conservative that they're not telling us the truth. And those few who are immediately excluded from any conversation or being invited on any show to talk about it because they'll tell the truth. We're out of time. And then you look every day, and they're not saying that the fires in California, the 21 trillion gallons of water that fell over 5 days in the Houston, Texas area, the worst in waterfall amount of water falling in recorded history in one area, that's going to happen again. And I live in an animal sanctuary down in Florida on a ranch. I got hit by Category 4. Not a single neighbor is moving. Yet all their property was damaged. Their roofs are still damaged. It's a year waiting list. And I said, you don't have a backup generator. You went 3 months without water and electricity. Well, you know, these things happen, but we're going to get hit now. A 4 is going to be considered normal. What are you going to do when we get hit with a 5? What's New York going to do when it gets hit with a 5? Or any city along the United States that gets hit with a Category 5? We got hit with a Category 1, and we still have not recovered Hurricane Sandy. And a Category 3, Katrina on New Orleans, still not recovered. The lower Ninth Ward has barely been touched. So the media is in denial. Science is in denial. The government is in denial. The citizen is in denial. The so-called best and brightest are in denial. I see no effort whatsoever to be honest about the fact that we're screwed. Now, those are my personal views. And as a scientist and a researcher, I stand behind them. We'll first start with you, Paul. Please take it from there. Wherever I'm wrong and error, please challenge me and correct me, and otherwise share your points of view. The forum is yours.
Yes. I don't have much to disagree on with your very good introduction and all of your points. I mean, what we're seeing this year with the global heat waves are just, you know, it's another one of these things where the climate system is changing faster than expected. And, you know, if you Google that term, climate change faster than expected, you get numerous hits. Whereas, you know, climate change rates going as expected or slower than expected, you get nothing. I mean, the heat in the north, you go up north of 70 degrees north latitude, northern, you know, up in northern Norway, Sweden, the temperatures are well over 30 degrees Celsius, and we'll get heat domes over these regions, and then we'll get torrential rains, and then back to heat domes. And, of course, the torrential rains up in the Arctic, this is exactly like monsoon behavior. The land heats up, hot air rises over the land. It's next to a coastline, next to the Arctic Ocean, which doesn't have ice in that region along the coastline. So there's evaporation of water from the ocean, and that moisture goes over the land, and it rises up with the hot air rising. The water vapor condenses and into clouds, and it fuels these massive storms and torrential rain events. And, of course, you know, we have a whole series of cascading feedbacks that are in motion. So the torrential rains on frozen ground, on permafrost, of course, will thaw out the stored carbon material, and which will then decompose and produce either CO2 or methane, which will then further increase the warming. So the root for the problems that we're seeing is just that the Arctic is completely changing to a region without snow and ice, and it changes the heat balance on the entire planet. The jet streams, the extreme weather events, everything changes, and people just don't, you know, the average person is starting to recognize, hey, there's something wrong, but people have been conditioned to, you know, be positive, you know, don't be alarmist, don't look at the negative things. But the reality is that we're in a heap of trouble. The consequences are becoming so severe. We're losing the carbon sinks on the planet. We're losing the vegetation. It's too hot. The soils dry out in these heat waves. And, you know, a spark, whether it be from some careless person or some car or some machinery or lightning, you know, it starts these fires, and these fires burn the entire vegetation in that region. And we can't assume if a forest burns down that a forest is going to regrow in that region, because the climate has shifted. So what we're seeing with some of these fires, like the Redding fire that you mentioned, the heat has been so strong, causing more and more uplift, there's rotation on that. I mean, there was a tornado generated essentially from that fire. It's people have heard of maybe the term fire-nado and things like that, but this is an outright tornado. I mean, it wrapped metal rods around trees and things like that. So We're basically in new ground. I mean, where it's going to hit people is in the global food supply. I think that's pretty clear. Grains and many crops are failing at the moment, and this is going to, when this trickles through the economic systems, we're going to get massive food spikes. You put it very nicely. You covered a lot of these different things, and maybe we'll see what Kevin can add. One thing I did want to mention is that large parts of the planet will become uninhabitable because these heat waves, when you combine them with high humidity, if you reach this wet bulb temperature of 35 degrees Celsius, that's 35 degrees Celsius and 100% humidity, the human body is not able to keep cool. You're not able to sweat. So if you're sitting in the shade, you die in about 6 hours under such conditions. So you basically can't be outside. A recent paper came out looking at one of the most populated areas of China, the northeast China plains, something hundreds of millions of people living there, and it's expected that in the not so distant future, people, large regions there will be uninhabitable because of because with climate change on top of the high humidity, and that's a breadbasket of China. So we're in a very serious situation, and politicians, the large corporations, we just don't have our act together at all, and people aren't even aware of it. We need to declare a global climate change emergency and try to do what we can to see if we can change where we're heading.
I appreciate your insights, Paul. Now, Paul, we're going to play, before we go to Kevin, we're going to play this short video. It's an animated video audio that you produced, I believe, and giving an overview. And I realize people cannot see it, but they can hear it, and it's well, let's say it's narrated so people can get the message. And just one thing before we go forward with that, which we will in a second. There are probably 5% of the American population who are fully conscious of the consequences of unhealthy choices, including the choice not to be plant-based with a vegan diet. That helps. To not buy things we don't need. That helps. To try not to clutter our lives with elements that are finite. That's conscious. That helps. To not waste food that we do have, and we currently waste more food than we actually consume in the United States, and also not to wait until we're given permission to move because of people thinking we're nut jobs, but rather to start looking and do your homework, where historically you would have said which would be the best 10 places in the world to live. You would have looked at their educational system, quality of life, the environment, the jobs and what they pay and opportunities in those jobs, especially for younger people, and what would mean if you're a family and raising kids. Is it a good area to live in? Today, those are all important, but today, my absolute first requirement would be, is this sustainable? And if it is, do I get any of the others with it? And more often than not, you have to make some choices. Do I want to be in a place that I know I'm going to have water and good soil, and it's not going to be excessive, and I'm not going to be susceptible to some of the global warming consequences, but I'm not going to have some of the other things I historically would have wanted. So we can't have it all today. That's simply, that cornucopia basket no longer presents itself. So I'm one of those people who believe, don't wait for everyone else to leave before you. Don't be the last person out of the room. Because you may not get out of the door. I sold my apartment in South Beach 6 years ago, and my broker said, you're stupid because everything is increasing in price. And I said, I would rather take the profit from this and look for a place that is sustainable for the future, so I'm not one of these people waiting and then seeing the price of food go sky high. And the fact that there are the wealthy people like the millionaires I mentioned and many of the professional class can afford to buy food, I says, think for a moment other than yourself. Do you have any idea what will happen when the rich or those in the upper mobile classes and the gated communities can afford to spend $5 for a loaf of bread. But the majority of Americans and people around the world can't. How long do you think it's going to be before you have food riots? Food riots, yeah. Why don't you take a look that there were 71 food riots in the Middle East just this past year? Oh, I didn't know that. So we have to not just look for our own interests, but look at what is the likely outcome when you suddenly have, as you mentioned, China. China's got the fastest desertification in the world. 27,000 towns and villages have been taken back by nature. People can't live there. And their largest river is so polluted they can't even use it to irrigate crops with, let alone purify drinking water. So what do you do when you have 1.3, almost 1.4 billion people, and you can't feed them, and you don't have quality water, even though you have beautiful cities and modern technology? You waited too late to finally realize that there had to be balance in what you spent your money on. And so now they're going to other countries that have land and resources, and they're buying up or renting up. So we have to look for ourselves today at intentional communities, quality of life communities, outside of the cities, outside of the suburbs, outside of those states that are going to be desert states. I predict Nevada will be uninhabitable for most people within 10 years. And all you have to do is look at the dynamics of Lake Mead that feeds it, and the Colorado River that gives it all of its water, and the fact that it has no aquifer for itself. Then look at 40 million Americans that get their water out of the Little Colorado, and without the mountain ice and snow packs melting over a 6 to 9 month period and feeding that river, and that's slowing down, then where's that water going to come from? And the Sierra Madres in Northern California, snow packs and water evaporation and is not feeding that canal the way it should. Yet more people are still moving into California than moving out. Different group of people, but you can't sustain that. So when you start to see a society collapse, no society collapse all at once, that's a myth. What you have is those who cannot support themselves, they collapse first. They're the ones who go without. They're the ones who are now homeless. 66 blocks where there's not one inch between one tent and another tent in downtown Los Angeles, and now the suburb, the road going down towards Malibu, every single inch by a homeless person. Never before in America have we seen that, not even in the Great Depression. And now that's happening in San Francisco. So first you see those who cannot sustain themselves, hanging into a society with the hope that there'll be some support. That's not happening. And then it comes the middle class, the people in the suburbs. We saw that with 7 million people losing their homes in the last, or from 2007-8 up through about 2013. And then what you have are green enclaves of the rich, and all the rich people around and the billionaires, they're already talking about what to do and where to be so we don't get taken down by the poorer classes. And this isn't even being discussed in the media, and it should be. Now let's go to this clip, and this is about 4 minutes long.
The National Weather Service declared a wet bulb alert for several states in the American South and Midwest. A wet bulb emergency occurs when the air is so hot and humid that people are unable to cool their bodies with perspiration. This is measured with a thermometer wrapped in wet cloth. Exposure to these conditions can result in death in a matter of hours. For 3 days, people sheltered anxiously in air-conditioned homes and public buildings, awaiting the passing of the lethal heat wave. They emerged from their air-conditioned shelters into a new reality. The ground was littered with dead birds. Dead leaves fell from lifeless trees. There was no denying anymore. The Earth's climate was rapidly changing, with lethal consequences for humans and other living creatures. When there was ice at the North Pole, the difference between cold Arctic air and warmer air in the mid-latitudes created a robust jet stream. But when the polar ice melted, the blue ocean underneath absorbed more heat and became warmer. The jet stream lost energy and became weaker, loopier, and more disorganized. Heat waves became hotter and lasted longer, worsening droughts, crops failed, famines increased. Slower, more powerful tropical storms and hurricanes caused catastrophic flooding. Worst of all, a rapidly warming Arctic Ocean unleashed a sleeping giant. Methane hydrates, frozen for eons, erupted into the atmosphere, accelerating global temperatures beyond what human life could endure in such a short time. With the sudden awareness that human beings were on the edge of extinction, the complex system we call civilization quickly unraveled. Without a future, the value of money, gold, stocks, and bonds vanished instantly. Without wages, workers walked off their jobs and just went home. Without workers and materials, industrial facilities shut down. Oil and gas, electricity, water and sanitation. The internet, telecommunications, and the media vanished overnight. Government, police, fire departments simply melted away. Supermarkets and warehouses were stripped of food within days. The search for food and clean water became the focus in everybody's lives. With the collapse of industry, pollutants that helped cool the earth by reflecting sunlight began to fall from the sky, resulting in a sudden increase in global temperatures. Without the intervention of modern medicines and machines, the chronically ill were the first to go. Epidemics and hunger cut down millions every day. Many people chose to take their lives rather than struggle to survive in a doomed world. Global temperatures all the while continued to rise, forcing more greenhouse gases and water vapor into the atmosphere in an accelerating, exponential feedback loop. Fires raged out of control in every city and every forest. Oceans too warm to absorb oxygen became lifeless except for vast mats of algae, which in turn died, emitting huge clouds of poisonous sulfur dioxide. Without proper maintenance, nuclear facilities across the planet began to melt down, spewing radioactive waste into the air and the sea. Leaking chemical and petroleum facilities damaged by storms added their toxic brew to the planet's rising waters. Small bands of humans managed to survive a few more years here and there, but as the environment became too toxic, these tiny vestiges succumbed and joined the long list of extinct species, the dinosaurs, the dodos, the passenger pigeons. The extinction event humans created continued to decimate life on Earth for many years. Only the tiniest creatures survived on the hostile planet. The Earth, once a blue and green jewel, would never recover.
Okay, that's very sobering. And I just saw that Dr. Gary Kohls, K-O-H-L-S, a very brilliant physician, just sent me an email, and it was a new book by Neil Potsman, and it's called Amusing Ourselves to Death, The Diagnosis for the Future Inhabitants of Our Dying Planet. And I think that should be considered also where we feel that something is overwhelming, that we can't comprehend it intellectually or emotionally. We have no way of properly processing such a bleak prognosis that we simply go into denial. We distract ourselves. So let us start now with you, Kevin, to go further on this journey of explaining what we're really facing, what is likely going to happen, what is happening now, how severe is it now. You might mention, you know, how bad it was in Japan, where they had the worst flooding in their history. People died. Then the worst heat in their history, immediately, not even a day separated, and then a typhoon this past weekend. And now that cycle could start all over again. And yet the Japanese are very conscientious of environmental impact and earthquakes. They do a lot, spend a lot on infrastructure, and all their infrastructure did not stop the disasters that befell them because they hadn't planned on heat. And no one is planning upon the fact that Antarctica and Greenland are melting much faster than any mathematical model had historically provided us. So we could be seeing major, major cataclysmic events in the next 3 to 5 years. The forum is yours.
I think it's clear for everyone to see now that climate sensitivity has been completely and utterly underestimated by the scientific community. and that things are unraveling much, much faster than anyone could really have thought possible a week, a month, or a year ago. Albert Bartlett has a great presentation where he talks about one of the greatest shortcomings of the human species is its inability to understand the exponential function. I think we're in the hockey stick phase of the unraveling of this biosphere, and I think it's going to shock the living daylights out of everybody. My personal view is that we are now a day-to-day, week-to-week, month-to-month proposition in terms of industrial civilization, and then by dint of that, complex life on the planet. Anything that would tip over industrial civilization in the coming days, weeks, and months would, to all intents and purposes, extinguish most complex life on this planet. Because the minute industrial civilization falls over, we get the loss of dimming, of global dimming, all our pollutants in the atmosphere. When those pollutants fall out of the atmosphere, the peer-reviewed science says that we're going to have something like 1.5 degrees C temperature spike, and that'll happen within days or a week. But I think it could be much more. Everything that we see is more faster than previously thought. And there's a huge mistake, and it's not a surprising mistake in a patriarchal, sapien-run planet where we think we know it all. We don't know it all. There's a whole lot of variables in this whole dichotomy that we don't know, and they are all compounding and having a multiplicative effect on what we're seeing. I honestly think that we should start planning for a very, very, very short time frame. I'll give you one example. A whole lot of us who are following the unraveling closely are looking for when are we going to have an ice-free Arctic? It could be this year, it could be next year, it could be in a few years' time. But I don't actually think that a fully ice-free Arctic will trigger the collapse of industrial civilization. I think it could happen much sooner. If we have one of those massive discharges of methane that Natalia Shakova and Igor Semelitov have predicted, that will change everything overnight. There's this really distinct possibility, and for me, a probability, that this will just topple over. We will wake up one day very soon, and the world that we all grew up in and loved with a passion won't exist anymore. Gary, you mentioned the president of Norway and his quote about if we lose the Arctic, we lose the world. He's one of the few world leaders who are prepared to speak up in some degree of truth. But the reality is it's much worse than that. All of these things are much worse than we're being told.
Give us an idea. Take it further with actual examples. For example, which tipping points is the public not aware of? Tell us the tipping point, where we're at, either tipping, not tipping yet, and how short the timeline is, the likely timeline, until we see things tip where one day, as I said, you wake up and the world has changed. Even if you're in an air-conditioned apartment in the middle of Manhattan, you got all the food you want down at the corner store, that is an illusion. Things will change. By the time we see the impact, it'll be too late. Go through that scenario now with us very clearly.
Well, as we speak, there are massive heat waves up in the northern hemisphere. Sam Karana from the Arctic News blog, he published an article just recently that said, on July 29th, 2018, the sea surface temperature near Svalbard was as warm as 18.9 degrees C, or 66 degrees Fahrenheit. That's an anomaly of 13.5 degrees C just since 2011. I think that we could just get a spike of methane, or we could have a mass death in a country like in Pakistan, where, you know, we're seeing thousands of people dying. If it's tens of thousands of people or hundreds of thousands of people, that will trigger the understanding in the global community that we've lost complete and utter control of the energy balance on the biosphere. And that could tip industrial civilization over. We know that since 2008, and capitalism has been just on life support. It's been on hospice with them printing money. When the crash happened in 2008, the velocity of money just plummeted. And the velocity of money is the concept of how often money changes hands. You know, you employ a plumber, he buys stuff at the shop, it gets put on a truck, da-di-da-di-da. That happens all the time. The minute that stops for a day or two or a week, we lose global dimming and we lose complex life on this planet. It seriously could be over that quickly. I know it's a dystopian perspective. I know it is hard to believe for people, but I think that's because everyone has toned down and downplayed the severity of the crisis. So no one's being prepared to look at how seriously bad it could really get and how quickly that could happen.
Let's be specific again, Kevin, if you would, please. Let's take a look at, you mentioned global dimming, when we stop our manufacturing, which is the irony. When you have manufacturing and you're creating particulate matter going in the air, that actually dims some of the sunlight, which keeps the planet a little cooler, even though ultimately it can also increase global warming. But one of the biggest problems we have are the methane bubbles that historically were trapped inside the very frozen tundra of Arctica, the Siberian Peninsula, the Russian steppes, and Norway, Canada, the Burl Forest. If you walk in the ground in the summertime, it was still frozen. Now it's thawing. And with that, you have peat. And when peat starts to burn, you can't put it out. It is the most difficult fire in the world to stop. And we have over 5 million acres of that, and it's burning. There are major fires in Antarctica, in Russia, in Siberia. And now we have giant holes, craters. They look 50 feet across, 100 feet across, and deep from methane. Now, when the Arctic floor begins to really release more of those methanes, we could theoretically have a gigaton to 5 gigatons of methane come up, and that could cause global warming overnight. Your thoughts, please, and to give us more of a picture of the world that we're not paying attention to.
I think what you just said is exactly true. And there's another thing that's coming out of the permafrost as well, and that's long dormant pathogens. We could have a pandemic come out of the Arctic tomorrow that could wipe out tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands, or millions of people in the north. But what that would do, it would show people that the game is up. And when one comes out, how do we know there's not going to be 100? We know anthrax came out and killed people and a whole lot of deer up there last year. That could easily be happening as we speak now. If we had that big burp of methane that's been hypothesized and we get that immediate increase in temperature, that would wipe out the grain growing areas in the northern hemisphere. Then the whole basis of civilization is the ability to store grains. That could be gone this time next week.
Guy McPherson, approximately 2 years ago, in an interview that I did with him on the air, said that he's looking at it was 13 years before the collapse of the ecological system begins in seriousness, and therefore the collapse of societies begin in seriousness. Not all at once, not everywhere at once, but when you can't grow food in certain areas that have been dependent on feeding people around the world, like from Montana and North Dakota and South Dakota and other sources like Kansas, no longer being able to grow because the temperature's gone up 3 to 4 degrees and seeds won't germinate, then he said, the American population won't starve to death, but a lot of people that are dependent upon that as their primary source of food will. So we're not planning on having environmental immigrants, but environmental immigrants could be as many as 300 to 400 million in Africa alone. The Middle East is completely screwed. There's not a country in the Middle East that's going to survive that what's happening as far as drought, no water. Even Saudi Arabia making artificial efforts It's a losing game. And yet no one's moving and no one's changing. And in fact, they put money, the head of Saudi Arabia, this young fellow, just bought the world's most expensive yacht, most expensive house, most expensive painting, a $1.5 billion he spent on himself. That is money that he should have been spending on looking at ways of creating some sustainable food systems like hydroponics and energy sources like solar-generated electricity with solar generators, not gas or gas or propane generators. But he didn't. So look at the world from that perspective. If you were just to be completely objective and you said, here's what you're doing in Africa, here's what you're doing in Southeast Asia, here's what you're doing in North America, South America, here's what you're doing in Canada, here's the mistake you're making because here's what's likely to come and here's what timetable. So now we're down to 9 years. But then recently I heard Guy McPherson say that we've got 5 years from the time that the Arctic is ice-free in the summer because of what it'll cause with the methane. Now, is that a realistic scenario or is that changing? Please address that. And then I'd like for you to do that as well, Paul.
I think it's really important to have a discussion around the whole story of Guy McPherson, because I think it's indicative. What happened to Guy when he joined the dots and started talking about where he saw this is going? He got attacked like no one has ever, but like no scientist has ever been attacked before. And I think what it's done is it's made all the other scientists on the planet really gun shy of talking about the severity of the crisis. And a lot of different people have talked about scientific. I think a huge amount of scientific reticence comes from every one of those scientists have watched how savaged and attacked and vilified Guy McPherson has been. And as a result, none of them are prepared to stick their heads above the parapet. How do you get research grants if you're talking like Guy does? You can't. There's no money in it. Our whole civilization has been monetized. Every last species has been monetized. If you can't monetize it, the dominant culture isn't interested. Over the cliff we go.
Paul, would you add your insights to that as well? Thank you.
Yes, I think, you know, none of us have a crystal ball in order, you know, we can't, there's so many things that we don't understand about the system that it's difficult to make, you know, a prediction down to a specific year or, you know, within a few specific years. But what we can do is we can follow trends and try to see, you know, where these trends are heading, for example, with sea ice loss. I mean, I think it's pretty clear. What I don't understand, you know, as far as scientists, they're over-reliant on models and really they fail to join the dots and to, you know, deal with the observations more than what the models are showing. I mean, if you look at the graphs of sea ice decline, whether it be the area or extent or volume, it's pretty clear that it's rapidly heading to zero, and yet you still hear modelers say, well, it's going to be 2040 or 2050 before we lose sea ice for the first year. Something could turn it around. And it's just not a realistic view at all. You know, you can show the graph to a six-year-old and say, where does it go to zero? And they can give you more accuracy than, you know, the bulk of computer models, for example. So I think, you know, there's a big failure in all elements of society. I mean, scientists are so specialized and so siloed, and they just don't see the overall picture, or they haven't up to now. And that's true in any profession. In order to get forward in your career, in life, one needs to be very specialized and focused just on one particular thing. But fortunately, there's more and more people that are, you know, are starting to look at the overall larger picture. So, you know, as far whether it be 5 years or 10 years or 20 years, you know, it's very difficult to make these predictions. I think what will happen is people that are predicting a demise, you know, a complete collapse, within a few years. I think they're going to be surprised that it takes a lot longer than they think. Whereas once it does happen, it will be extremely fast. But as you said, you know, you don't collapse around the planet simultaneously. There's different countries, different places that are at much greater risk of collapse than other places. We're already seeing this collapse occurring, you know, in various places. And, you know, the problem is what it does is it makes countries turn inward. It makes countries want to build walls and keep everybody else out. It brings up the racism rears its ugly head. It becomes a matter of survival just for yourself and to hell with everybody else. And this falls perfectly in line with far right wing politicians and far right wing ideology. It's amazing that people just have not evaluated the risks properly. The risks of abrupt climate change are enormous. And yet, for example, in the U.S., you know, Homeland Security has looked at other risks which are nowhere near significant compared to the risks that we all face from abrupt climate change. So, it's not a good situation at all. And as far as the sea ice goes, it's going to greatly accelerate extreme weather events around the world. I mean, our weather patterns, our storms, are very much guided by the jet streams. And as the jet streams get weaker and weaker and more fractured and broken, these storms are then more guided by regional factors, local factors, like the air-sea contrast. So coastlines, for example, you know, we can expect regions to just get, perpetual rain in a way for months on end, and other regions to just get drought for months on end. So growing food is going to be our biggest problem.
Thank you. I appreciate that insight, Paul. Last year, for the first time in 22 years of my living in Florida at my animals ranch sanctuary, the fires were so many in southwest Florida that they were simply not being attended to. They were just burning until they burned out. And in my area, they burned right up to a quarter mile. I had anticipated this, putting fire hoses on all the roofs, having ladders on all the roofs, having fire retardant suits, evacuating all the animals, and having hoses, large hoses, 4-inch hoses out of 4-inch wells, the same as a fire truck would have on every single building, and then putting fire retardant materials. So, and then sprinkler system that covered 35 acres. So when the flames came across the street, literally I could throw a rock and hit the flames and just devastating the neighbor's property, mine was soaked. Now, my neighbor could have done that. They chose not to. They could have prepared. People are not preparing. Now we had a dry winter, fires again. And now we had a hurricane, Category 4. There's a high probability that we'll have another heavy hurricane. And if we do, then you're going to start to see with the Category 4 or 5 again, when we haven't recovered from the first one this year, 9 months ago, and you have another one on top of that, and your insurance isn't covering you, and you don't have the money to rebuild, and there's a year waiting list, then you'll start to see the forced evacuation, or people voluntarily evacuating and saying, I'm not going to go through this again, because it literally takes a full year to fully recover if you have any kind of property at all. So I think that just the circumstance, the poor people, because who gets creamed the most by weather events? Poor people. Who got creamed down in Houston? Not the rich people up in the tower buildings. They were okay. They were dry. But all the million poor people who lived in the west part of Houston, they were at sea level. And all those chemical and refineries overflowed, and all that toxic material that's in those refineries went into the water, came down into the ground. Not an inch of that's been cleaned up. They're living in a toxic brew. Their homes have mold. No one went in there to clean up their homes. In fact, if anything, they were forbidden to go back in the home but had no other home to go to. So you're going to see this happening more and more. But because most people in America are watching these events on television, including last week, there's something that should really concern people. For the first time that I'm aware of in American history, we had a tsunami fire, what is called a firestorm, not a fire. You never hear firestorms, but they did. And they measured some of those flames going 300 feet. Well, that and the fire chief said there's nothing any human being can do. There's nothing we can do. We got to get out of the way because it can destroy everything in its path. And it did till it burns itself out. That's the new norm in Colorado now. So when you get parts of the country that are not being hit, the people seem to disconnect. And parts where it is hit, they got to be hit like 3 or 4 or 5 times in a row over 4 or 5 years. Then they finally get it. Maybe we should move. And then we'll start to see movement. But there are already people ahead of this curve. There are people going into places that are sustainable, building homes, including berm homes, that are much better aesthetically. They're beautiful, like out of The Hobbit, but which are much better for variations in weather and flooding. Growing even indoors, they're growing hydroponics. So there's a whole movement by about 5 million to 10 million Americans to make a sustainable future. Now, I'm not saying people have to run out tomorrow and do this. I'm saying that they better start doing their education level awareness. What do I have to do for the future? And then make meaningful and intelligent choices so they're not victimized like so many people now, unfortunately, are. Final thoughts from you, Kevin, and final thoughts from you, Paul.
What both you and Paul said in the last two segments where you both spoke is what you've enunciated is the complete abandonment of the precautionary principle. It used to be a fundamental part of science and it's been abandoned. I'm going to be a little cheeky here and I'd like to ask Paul if it's possible he'd come on my show, Nature Bats Last, in October and we continue the discussion then. Paul, are you up for that?
Yes, sounds great, Kevin.
Good.
Wonderful.
Paul,
thank you both for all your work you're doing for us.
Thank you. Kevin Hester from New Zealand, and his website is kevinhester.live. Paul, final thoughts, please.
Yes. I think, part of the human condition is to always have some sort of hope, right? And, things are very dark. There's not a lot of opportunity for seeing hope in terms of what politicians are doing, et cetera. I think we still need to kind of churn on and try to educate as many people as we can about the grave dangers that we face and also prepare ourselves for what is happening. And, the entire planet doesn't collapse simultaneously. So, we're seeing more and more grief in different places, and I like to think that at some point, governments, whether it be military or whoever, actually says, "Hey, this is a real problem. Is there a way we can suck CO2 out of the atmosphere? Is there a way we can cool the Arctic?" These sort of things seem impossible right now, but who knows? We can't completely predict the future.
I agree with that, but I'm not going to allow anyone else's lack of predicting the future affect my wanting to predict my own future and be proactive in that. Remember, we should have a Marshall Plan worldwide. Every country in the world should be engaged in solving the problem cooperatively together. And yet, as of today, Fukushima is still spewing hundreds of thousands of gallons of radioactive water into the Pacific. 6 years now, not a single thing has been done at the world level to stop this, including creating sarcophagus around the planet as they did with Chernobyl. And so I'm not optimistic at this time that the help in our future survival and sustainability is coming from any official source because it hasn't up to this point. But who knows?
Yes.
You get a big enough cataclysmic event, then maybe people are in enough pain to demand attention. Thank you very much, Paul, Professor Paul Beckwith, for being with us. I'm Gary Noll. We're out of time. Thank you all for listening. Have a nice day.
Hey, what's happening? Brother, what's up?
This is a big party, man.
Yeah, brother, digging.
Mother, mother, there's too many of you crying. Brother, 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 there's